This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Fantastic to have you with us for another Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. On today's episode, burnout. World Health Organization saying that working more than 55 hours a week can lead to premature death, heart disease and stroke. So how would you rate your burnout score from 1 to 10? Many of you getting in touch to share your experiences. And we spoke to several experts from both the world of well-being but also worlds of recruitment about what we can be doing better to avoid burnout. And as a parent, have you pushed your child into a certain job, or what did your parents want you to do versus what you're actually doing today? We met Maz, whose parents' expectations pushed him in a certain direction until he changed his mind. What were his parents' reaction to that? And if you're struggling to get on the same page or even in the same book as your teen, we were speaking to Audrey Hemetner from the Bedrock Programme with her expert advice. As ever, we love talking money, and it was Hayley Yoon. She is a tech startup entrepreneur and engineer sharing her money diaries. And what if you think you're in the wrong job? Do you need to change your life or just change your mindset? A career coach was on hand to help.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking health and careers this afternoon because a recent study at the World Health Organization and the International Labour Organization found that working at least 55 hours a week was causing hundreds of thousands of us getting to premature deaths. It was linked to a higher risk of stroke and heart disease. Long hours were described as a serious health hazard. Burnout is the name to this host of symptoms caused by overwhelming stressful environments. You could be getting symptoms like fatigue, muscle aches, headaches, stomach issues, and of course psychological effects as well, like loss of motivation, listlessness, tearfulness, and numerous surveys have found that burnout is increasing, especially in this last year, as work-life boundaries become hugely blurred by people working from home and massive anxiety over job security as well. Dating app Bumble last week announced it was going to temporarily close all its office for a week to combat workplace stress. 700 staff told to switch off and focus on themselves. Joined on the line now by Danny Hakim, founder of Safe Space. Danny, the global workforce is in danger of a burnout. You heard there Bumble giving its employees an extra week off, acknowledging it's a very real problem. Are you seeing this with the people that you're working with at Safe Space?
Yeah, very much. We do a lot of work with businesses trying to help bring productivity, work-life balance, but essentially even no amount of workshops or, you know, wizardry or magic can take away when someone is really under that pressure and the pressure just kind of keeps building. I went through a pretty murky burnout in about 2017, so learned the hard way. And really, for me, it was about that lack of transparency and such high stigma in office spaces. A lot of people just don't want to admit that they're feeling so rubbish because it's just seen as this sign of weakness and that you're not kind of there, that you can fulfill the job that you were meant to do. So I think leadership have a lot to do to sort of break that barrier.
Which is why I was really encouraged by this Bumble move. And, you know, they've got, let's be honest, they've got some great PR out of it as well. But what it really speaks to is you can say to someone, oh, have a duvet day, you know, have a day off, rest up. But you're always going to keep your eye on your phone. You're always going to keep an eye on your emails. If everyone is taken out of the equation, everyone is not working, then presumably you won't come back to that deluge of emails that you kind of spend that day off dreading. Coming back to your experience, Danny, a few years ago, what I mentioned some of the symptoms there, you know, listlessness, feeling tearful, inability to make a decision, and some physical symptoms as well. What was your own experience like?
I think I tick quite a lot of those boxes. It really affected both mental and physical health, and got to the point where I just couldn't handle, you know, small things like bad feedback in a client meeting. I broke down in tears in front of, you know, a global, very senior team, and the wheels just kind of continued to fall off the more that I just pushed these symptoms under the surface and didn't admit them, both to myself and to the people around me.
And was there a breaking point where you thought, I need to make a big life change now?
I actually lost my job because of it in the end, which, you know, at the time kind of felt like the straw that was going to break the camel's back. in hindsight, can look back that that's exactly what I needed. I needed to step away from the busy agency that I was working in. I needed to become a little bit more aware and take some time just to kind of take stock and start to build up my sort of strength and resilience again, because it was at ground zero by that point.
And I know an awful lot of people have had a huge amount of job stress recently, compounded by the pandemic and compounded by the uncertainty we've had when it comes to our personal lives as well. You know, I put a post up on my Instagram over the weekend just saying that I had a really tough week last week and felt really just raw and tearful and just a bit sad. And I'm lucky in that, you know, I'm working in the afternoons. I do get some time with the kids in the morning, but I feel like an awful lot of people just feel like they're being pulled in a million different directions and can't see light at the end of the tunnel. With some of the companies that you're working with, and you're mentioning leadership being really crucial there, Danny, as well. If you could wave a magic wand and I'm just thinking about a collective duvet day for the UAE where we all just throw our phones in the sea. What would you like to see happen in companies?
I'd just like there to be a little bit more honesty and transparency, really. I think a lot of leadership are going through the same, but there's just this exterior that needs to be maintained, you know, onwards and upwards, and we'll get through this together. And I think that vulnerability, that, you know, showing and expressing of emotions, it's okay to feel sad. It's completely human and normal to, you know, feel a whole range of emotions, these emotions that we've classified as like bad emotions, you know, anger and sadness, despair. And I think we just need to start opening up a little bit more to that emotional rainbow at work and start from there, really.
So many people getting in touch on this. And I, as I said, I was completely overwhelmed by both messages on Instagram and comments as well, which just goes to show sometimes it just takes someone to stand up and go, yeah, I'm not all right. And to kind of normalise not being OK. And that's exactly what we're doing this afternoon. Danny, for anyone who wants to contact you guys at Safe Space, learn a little bit more about a bit of self-compassion and kindness, but also how it can play a part in work as well. What's the best way of getting in touch with you guys?
You can check out our website, which is www.wearesafespace.com, and we can go from there.
And thank you so, so much for sharing your experiences today. I think it's really, really important to acknowledge what can happen when you are pushed to the brink.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
What is your burnout score on a scale of 1 to 10? Where are you at? 1 being not a care in the world, 10 thinking about, you know, well, maybe having a little ER visit and a bit of time out. Share your story with us. Lots of you getting in touch. 8 or 9 messages come in. And no name on this one. You can be anonymous saying, but not because of career. I love my kids to bits, but finding myself short and irritable and wishing for a week away without them. Family time seems stressful. Work is stressful. And weekends and holiday don't seem like a break. Mass is saying, my heart goes out to my children's teachers. I'm so glad we're vaccinated and that classrooms are open again. Switching to distance learning almost overnight was extremely tough for them. We are addressing the topics of teachers on the show this afternoon. I know it's incredibly challenging time over the year. So let us know your burnout score on a scale of 1 to 10. Now, dating app Bumble announced last week it was going to temporarily close all of its offices, that's 700 staff worldwide, to combat workplace stress. So a week of paid vacation. And Shane Phillips of the Phillips Group disagrees with this as a solution. Shane, tell us your reasoning behind that.
Well, I don't think you need to have extra days because you already have 30 sick days. So if you need more than 30 sick days in a year, then you obviously have larger issues. You're probably not fit for work.
It's 30 days. Do people have 30 days sick days? Do people use them?
It's illegal. That's the law. So you have 30, you're allowed to use 30 sick days. And so that would include burnout. That would include migraines. That would include any kind of personal thing that you have. And, and I think now the kind of modern way of thinking about this is to just abolish sick days and you use it as a personal day. And, you know, because you don't want to start saying to your boss, oh, you know, I'm having this medical issue or I'm having a colonoscopy, for example. You don't want to say that in public. You just say, look, I have a personal thing I have to take care of. You say, fine.
I think, Shane, the point of difference with this Bumble decision is that everyone's off at the same time. You know, I think when people have a sick day, they're still perhaps keeping an eye on their phone. They still feel like they're somewhat accountable, or they're dreading going back into the office, or certainly online, and being confronted with that huge amount of work. That kind of what I used to think of being like that Sunday night homework feeling that you know you're going to have to get the work done at some point. Surely by having a collective break, everyone gets to breathe a bit of a sigh of relief.
A collective break. I mean, I think if the work is too much that's burning you out, you should quit your job because you're not excited. You're not energized. So you didn't see, you know, Vincent Van Gogh when he's making a painting get burned out. So you
I think
know,
he did. He cut off his ear. That's
that
not
enjoy.
Very healthy.
I mean,
he cut off his ear. It didn't work out terribly well. He clearly wasn't dealing with the pressures of artist world particularly well.
He didn't need that ear. He had two. So. No, but
I know what you're saying.
The thing is that you are in a role that you don't like, and you are then. You know, one of the things we'll do in HR is we'll identify those employees who are taking more sick days or the most sick days. And generally, those are the people who will be really disengaged. There's a clear correlation between the amount of sick days you work and how you take and how engaged you are with your work, how passionate you are about your work. Do you find a deep sense of purpose and meaning in your work? And then help those people transition into roles that they do like or that they do enjoy.
I love the theory behind this. I really do. I just think I'm kind of concerned about the impact of the pandemic where you might have teams of 16 being reduced down to two, and you might essentially love what you do, but you don't want to do 14 other people's work on top of your normal workload for perhaps no money. People are under a huge amount of stress right now and are, you know, very concerned about losing their job. So that work-life balance, as I said, it become a health crisis. 55 hours a week, you know, increasing the risk of strokes and heart disease. Surely something big has got to change across our philosophy around work and perhaps not fetishizing being busy in this beast mode and being productive and not taking sick days. I don't think you get a medal for not taking those sick days.
Well, I can say on just an interesting point here, because I get to work with people at all stages of their career path. And one of the things we get to do is we work with people who are semi-retired or, you know, that individual who's 65 or 67 and mm-hmm. still wants to do consulting or whatnot. And you can see the people who work in jobs where, you know, they're really not challenged. They're getting lots of time off. They're really not working a full day. You know, there's some jobs where you're done at 2 o'clock or whatnot. And then when you deal with these people in semi-retirement, you can see that the cognitive ability is deteriorated more quickly in those individuals who have not worked hard. And the individuals who are, you know, generally the entrepreneur who worked 80 hours a week, 7 years old, he's still sharp as a razor, or she's still sharp as a razor, because the brain has been engaged, the body's been engaged. And so it's actually healthy for you to work. Your body, your brain, your mind and soul are designed for work. In fact, people will say work is worship. And so you actually may be giving yourself a disservice health-wise by giving people days off. In fact, if you want to be healthy, that's the last thing you want to do. And as the idiom goes, you know, devil does something.
Or we just
get
to watch, you know, Too Hot to Handle and eat some toast and have a bit of an afternoon nap. And that's a happy time indeed. So if time off's not the answer in your book, Shane, last question. How do you think bosses can show their staff that they are appreciated, that they're heard, and that perhaps they do need to make some kind of adjustments to make sure everyone is healthy, happy and engaged?
Yeah. And so when you do have someone who's really engaged, they will tend to, they might work overwork. And so I think that's the manager's job at that point to step in and say, hey, look, you really need to take a break here. You know, you're really going to take Thursday off, you know, shut down their laptop. If you have to take the laptop away from the employee and force them to. And you can also have, you know, non-financial rewards where you're saying, like, here's a voucher for, you know, 4-day getaway, all inclusive, you know, board and hotel at X resort paid. You and the family go relax. And I think you have to do that, because when you start to see some employees who are burned out, who really are pushed themselves too far, yeah, you know, that's your job, is knowing when to help pull people back and when to give them that nudge so that they run a bit faster.
Oh, well, Shane, I have to say, I'm glad you're not my boss, my friend. Good to have you on the show, though. Always a pleasure to hear from you.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're talking burnout this afternoon, and it could be complete loss of interest in your job. It could be taking a lot of time to make decisions, to take action. It could be physical symptoms, you know, ulcers, muscle ache, fatigue. The World Health Organization and the International Labour Organization has found that working around 55 hours a week is causing hundreds of thousands of premature deaths, high risk of stroke and heart disease. Many people working in an overwhelming or stressful environment. And of course, this last year, completely compounding that, work-life boundaries become blurred and anxiety over job security has increased. So what is your burnout score on a scale of 1 to 10? 1 being totally easy breezy, don't know what you're talking about, Helen, to 10, I'm on the brink, I'm past the brink. And many of you getting in touch on this. Where are you at? No name saying 11 or 12. Mo says, because of work, perhaps 6 to 7, but because of bad management, 12. And we had a message earlier from Massa talking about teachers, and that's exactly what we're addressing this afternoon. So we did hear earlier, dating app Bumble announced last week it's going to temporarily close all of its offices to combat workplace stress. So everyone, 700 members of staff, all collectively switching off for a week. Shane Phillips, against the idea, but what about you? Let us know. It is a global phenomenon, and there are, of course, so many different professions and industries that are overworked, and they include our dear teachers. Heather Broderick is a teacher and will soon be leaving her beloved profession, but she will be staying in the education space, training educators to achieve work-life balance during these really difficult times. Heather, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. Can I ask you what your burnout score is?
At the moment, I don't know. I think it reaches burnout when you get to about an 8 or a 9. I'd say the average teacher probably functions on a 6 or a 7 daily, just with the demands of the job and the things that are asked of them, the time commitments even. But I'd say once it gets to an 8 or a 9, like you were saying, and it affects your sleep, your lifestyle, maybe your eating habits, maybe mood swings and exhaustion, I think that's the time that you need to kind of reconsider or take a day off or something to find that rebalance again.
Well, it's interesting because we think about this last year and how much teachers have had to adapt to, and often doing distance learning and in-class learning, working around different ways of communicating information, of generating reports. And can you talk us through a typical kind of day in the life, because there's a lot of misconceptions, like, oh, you're done by 2 o'clock and then you get a 3 month summer, happy days. The reality, far from that.
Yeah, I suppose the most teachers I'd say would have to be in school around 7, so it depends on where you live. You're leaving around 6:30 in the morning maybe, and then you're kind of preparing your lessons, waiting for your class to come in, and then really it's just a mix of lessons, planning, feedback, marking throughout the day. Then, yeah, you're right. The lessons normally generally finish around 2:30 or 2:45. And then after that, you normally have something till around 4 every day, whether it's a meeting, a training, parents' evening, some kind of planning for an event or something. So generally, you won't be finished your actual, you won't get downtime really till around 4. So it's about a 7 till 4 job of the kind of basics, and then if you've got work to take home or you're behind on marking or you're planning an event or doing a trip, then that's extra on top of that. So
I think parents now would unfortunately include myself in this, we often forget to check in on our teachers, because our priority as parents is our children's education. What we want to see at that door is a nice happy smiley face, and for our kids to be coming home happy and smiley after having a good positive day, and perhaps don't really think about what's been happening behind the scenes. You are leaving the profession but continuing to work closely with teachers. What are you hoping to address with them?
I'm going to be offering a couple of courses with an educational provider of professional development. I'm going to do one course for teachers looking at work-life balance and dealing with emotions in the workplace, and then one also for leaders on how to make a team gel, looking at kind of relationships within a team, getting people on side, that kind of thing. And I really hope to try and get stay in education, doing a bit on mindfulness and the well-being side of things. So to see how that pans out.
I'm glad we're talking about it, because I had a chat with our principal the other morning. I was like, this is great, you know, winding down at the end of term. And he looked at me like I was completely lost my mind. He's like, this isn't winding down. This is proper crunch time. So thinking of all of you educators, Heather, thank you so much for sharing your experiences and why it is so important to check in them. We've got Bea now sharing her story from the teaching profession.
It started to get noticeable last year, probably towards the latter part of the year. I was working a job that I really wasn't enjoying, and I was working long, long hours, anywhere between 10 to 14 hours a day, usually 7 days a week. It just started to take its toll on me. I'm a mum, I try and manage the household, the kids, family life, and then this job. And I think what was really interesting for me is I started to see it in a physical sense. So my immunity was low. I was getting sick a lot more frequently, and I decided to do something about it. Obviously, I had some blood work done, my vitamin levels, my iron levels. I changed my lifestyle. I was fortunate enough that I could leave my job, and I started exercising, eating well, trying to sleep more and sleep better and utilize my at home time better to relax and look after myself. And it's really, really helped. I feel really terrific this year. It's been awesome. And I'm really glad I was able to address that for myself.
Bea, obviously incredibly lucky there that she could get out of her situation by leaving that job, and really thinking of everyone who hasn't got that luxury or privilege to do that. Everyone who is the sole provider, who is sending money home and really can't see a way out. You're very much not alone, and there's so many of you getting in touch just saying how burnt out you are. One, I presume, sarcastic message here saying, on top of the world after an amazing global cut-a-thon on Saturday. No name on this, and saying, my wife's burnout score will be 15, but if she heard Shane Phillips, it might just jump to 20. Alisa sharing, I hate being told that I shouldn't validate my burnout or breakdowns, as there are people who have it worse than you. And imagine telling your boss you're worked out. And the answer is, well, expectations of 10 hours a day minimum, and stress is normal. So many of you on the brink.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Discussing burnout this afternoon, and oh, I don't know, misery loves company, doesn't it? But it is upsetting to hear how tough a lot of you have got it right now when it comes to your stress levels. And I think it's really important that we have these conversations, that we acknowledge that everyone is not really okay right now. And that can be through a combination of enormous job stress, but not just professional stress as well. It can be families, it can be uncertainty, it can be illness and perhaps not being with friends and family right now. So really are thinking of you today. And we're joined on the line by Chloe Reed. She's a food and prop stylist, trained as a chef, and she's here to share her story. Chloe, when did you realise that you were suffering from burnout?
Hi, Helen. Hi. Probably around just before the pandemic, I was starting to feel extremely stressed with work. And then over the pandemic, obviously, lots of people were let go from areas of jobs, especially in my company. And I think looking around and realizing that you're one of the last ones standing, like, can sometimes be a positive thing, but it also can increase workloads as well. Mm-hmm. And that was a massive turning point for me, realizing that, you know, the pay freezes weren't going to be finishing anytime soon. The pay wasn't going up. The bonuses weren't going to start to coming like they were before. And we were just being given more and more work. It's almost terrifying when you can't sort of see when that's going to finish. Mm-hmm. So that was a really big turning point for me.
And what were some of the signs? What were you suffering from yourself? We mentioned all sorts of different symptoms from, you know, insomnia and fatigue, muscle aches, brain fog. What was it like for you?
For me, I ended up going on to medication for anxiety. I had, luckily, an incredible doctor that I was blessed to be able to talk to through the whole situation. She really, really helped me to sort of realize that I was still the person that I was before all of it started. Mm-hmm. Everything was fine. I still could do the jobs that I loved doing. I just needed, my mentality to shift back to what it was before and become the person that I was before, really, and taking that element of the pressure from the people above away and going freelance has just like absolutely changed my life. I just love my job again. I love what I'm doing. It's just so rewarding. But definitely being able to talk to someone about it and talk through it just helped me so much.
I think when we're in it, you're so in it, you know, like, it's so hard to create that distance and get that perspective. And we talk about our jobs like they are us. We say, I'm an accountant, I'm a writer, rather than I'm Helen, who happens to do some writing and I present on the radio. You know, it becomes all consuming in this big sense of identity. And what you've done is kind of flip it in some ways and take back some control and put some boundaries in place on how you're spending your time and how you view yourself. I hate to ask, but in terms of the finances, has that side worked out as well? Because that's obviously a huge concern for a lot of people who are thinking about making a change or even going freelance like you did.
Yeah, 100%. It's the first question that people ask me all the time when as soon as I say I'm going freelance. So obviously the best thing that I found is talking to other freelancers, and not just one, but multiple, because in Dubai, there's lots of avenues that you can go down to get certain visas, and lots of people decide to do things in different ways. So it's, I think, important to find the best way to do it for you. The best thing that I did and that I've always loved doing is made a lot of lists. With a lot of different scenarios. This is how much it would cost if I did it this way. Mm-hmm. This is how much time it's going to take. I can save this amount. I can, you know, move that money around. But the biggest, I was very lucky that I got some inheritance a few years ago that I had just sort of left that I was able to use to help me. But definitely saving and having a lump sum for the first couple of months while you're building up those clients,
took the pressure
off. Quite important to have. Yeah,
Chloe, I think it's amazing you were able to recognize in that moment the changes that you need to make, and thank you again for sharing your story. It sounds like it's nice to end on a positive. It really is, after some of the messages we've had over the course of the last hour. So wishing you and your business all the very best over the coming months and years. Chloe Reed there, joining us as a food and prop stylist, trained as a chef, and went freelance after suffering from considerable burnout.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
What is your job now? Is it what your parents wanted for you? My parents, in honesty, and I don't know if they were just, you know, trying to be nice, was like, as long as you do your best, if you want to be a toilet cleaner, make sure you're the best toilet cleaner in the world. I do have a letter that was written to Santa saying, when I would grow up, I wanted to be a crocodile. But I remember saying I wanted to be a QC, I wanted to be a barrister, which was complete nonsense. I didn't want to do that at all. It was just what I thought my parents wanted to hear. And we're joined now by Maz. Maz, how are you?
Hi, good afternoon, Helen. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for being with us today. And lots of people getting in touch with some of the career choices their parents had for them versus what they're actually doing. Initially, you took up mechanical engineering, but that wasn't your choice. Can you tell us more?
Right. So just a little background before I get into that. So I come from a long family line of doctors and engineers, you know, specifically on my father's side. And from my mother's side, you know, they were mostly civil servants. So the expectation for me growing up was more or less in that line of work. And in the beginning, I wouldn't really say that I was pressured into getting into one of these, you know, careers. But at the same time, I would say that I didn't know anything else, you know. All I knew was these career paths of, you know, doctor, engineer, lawyer even. And following your dreams wasn't considered to be realistic. And it was, and the assumption was that, you know, doctors, engineers, lawyers, these professions are the cream of society. They are well-respected, well-paid individuals. And if you want a sure shot at success, you know, that is the path to go on. So I didn't really know much about anything else growing up. So finally, when I started applying for college, I was applying for an engineering course. So I took this course up on the wishes of my parents, and it was something that, you know, they were very happy about, very proud about, and I wanted to give it a shot. So I'm at this point now wherein I've entered university. I've left my hometown. You know, I've come to Dubai, and at this point, I'm exposed to a lot of different things. You know, I'm meeting people from, you know, different universities, pursuing different career paths, doing different things, journalism, media, whatever, commerce. And it did have an effect on me because, you know, I was seeing that there is a world beyond these three careers, and there are people, I mean, there are kids my age who are pursuing these career paths. So nevertheless, I decided to take up that subject for a year. The subject was good. It was interesting, you know. Obviously, better part of my high school life, I was preparing for this, you know, mm-hmm. like getting good at math, physics, obviously, base fundamentals. So I go through this 1 year of 12 months, you know, and I felt that something was amiss, for sure. You know, I had friends who were pursuing careers they were passionate about, and interested and excited, and, you know, enthusiasm and whatnot. And I noticed that, yeah, sure, I was good at the subject. They were, you know, in my batch, there were kids who were better than me, but I could go through the lectures, I could study the theories, but, you know, I didn't have that passion for it. I had to sit my ass down, you know, put in the work, put in the effort, and I felt like something was amiss. Mm-hmm. And it was a very important point in my life, because I knew that if I was going to pursue something, I wanted to be the best at it. And mm-hmm. it's very difficult to compete with someone who is interested and passionate about something
and good at it. So you were ticking the boxes when it came to the academics, but there wasn't a passion. You were feeling a bit flat.
Right, for sure. So one thing was certain, right? One thing was certain, that I was like, you know what? I know that, you know, I'm not sure what I want to do, but I'm sure that this is not something I want to pursue for the rest of my life.
Well, Maz, we're going to find out next what it was that you decided to do and how you broached that with your family. Let us know, what was the job that your parents wanted you to do versus what you're actually doing? We've had lawyer or doctor, typical Indian family. I am a lawyer now. I wanted me a judge. I became a pilot.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So what is your job now? And what is it that your parents wanted for you? Lots of you getting in touch as well on Instagram. How are saying, wanted me to be a doctor. I am a designer. Liana saying, I was selling concrete in the UK. My mum pushed me to follow my dream and do music full time here. Doctor versus businesswoman. What about you? Lisa got in touch. Patrico, stand up.
Filipino moms predetermine what their kids are supposed to be when they grow up. There's a lot of Filipinos in here right now that are nurses. That's a great job, great benefits, good money. I'm just saying, it wasn't your dream.
He did not follow that instruction. It's working out pretty well. So should parents have a say, or should they leave it completely up to their kids on what they decide to study and become? We're joined now by Maz, who says his family chose mechanical engineering for him to study, but he had to be honest and shift gears during uni. So Maz, you were studying well, things were going well on paper, but you were just feeling a little bit flat. And it wasn't as if you'd gone to university with different dreams. You hadn't gone there saying, I want to be, you know, a tech entrepreneur, or I want to start my own coffee business. You weren't really sure what it was you wanted to be. It just wasn't mechanical and engineering. And you came to Dubai and had your eyes opened. So tell us about the process then of being honest with your family about wanting to change direction.
Yeah, sure. So obviously, you know, my parents are very near and dear to me, and I didn't want to be disobedient or rebellious towards them, but I wanted to get the point through. And this is something that is that was a very important. It was a very important factor, you know, while I was going in to break the news. So. I knew I didn't want to do this subject. So what my plan was that Let me take up another branch within engineering, but a branch that could have more scope and focus, and something that can, something of the future, something that can branch out, something that I might have more interest in. So the idea was I would switch from, mechanical engineering to computer science engineering. And in computer science engineering, I mean, today the scope is humongous. I mean, you've got big data, you've got AI specialists, network security specialists. On the creative side, you've got graphic designers and whatnot. So it kind of branches out. And I couldn't, if I had an opportunity, I would have maybe come out of engineering completely, but that was a compromise that I wanted to make. So me and my dad comes to visit me in Dubai, and we go to this Nando's restaurant, for dinner. And, we sit down, we're having a good time. He asks me, how are things going, and, how your class is, and are you excited and whatnot. It was a good evening until I broke the news to him. So I told him, look, Dad, I'm going to be honest with you. This year is coming to a close. I have an opportunity of switching branches for the next academic year. And I don't feel like I can continue with mechanical engineering. I don't see myself being a mechanical engineer. So all of a sudden he goes silent. And then after a few seconds, he goes like, so what do you want to do? So I say, I want to go and do computer science engineering. So here's the point wherein all the stereotypes start coming out, right? So he says, so what, you're going to be an IT technician fixing laptops all day for others, running from office to office and doing whatnot. So I said, no, not really. It's probably going to be more than that. There was a disagreement. There was a little bit of a fiasco. But in the end, I stood my ground and I told them, look, let me do this and you're not going to regret it. I'm going to be successful. I'm going to make it count. Believe in me and let me do this. So obviously that was the first stage. And we had a few conversations after that. He's a very persistent guy, my dad. He'll try and get me out of it, but since I'm his son, I'm also equally persistent. So
he met his match.
Yeah,
he made his match.
Yeah, he did. And I'll be honest with you, my dad, right? He loves his job. He loves his job, and I see. When I was little, I had the opportunity of going to work with him and to see him in that energy, in that space, in his prime. That's something I wanted. So I then switched to computer science engineering. It did happen, and over the next 3 years, I was studying computer sciences, and at the same time, I took up internships in different areas of work, such as marketing, sales. And I was an IT network specialist for some point of time.
So what are you doing now, Maz? How is it? How has it turned out?
Right. So I currently have a startup. I have a small tech startup, and me and a bunch of friends and angel investors, we pulled in our resources, and now we have a startup. We are providing IT resources and digitization to small and medium-sized businesses, right from app development, website development, SEO optimization, chatbot creation, you name it. And we are in the process of developing a really good application for the market, and which we think will impact society in a major way. So,
and it sounds like you're excited about it. None of that flatness anymore. It sounds like you're doing what you want to be doing, and you're forging your own path. Does your dad know you're on the radio today or not?
Yeah, for sure he does know, but he's abroad. He's not in Dubai with me, but he does know I'm on the radio. So funny thing, I told him, hey Dad, I'm going on the radio to talk about so and so, and he goes like, oh really? So then he's like, so So are you trying to like make all the other kids rebellious like yourself? And then I go like, no, that's not the objective. But, you know, I told him, I told him was I'm going there so that there is a better understanding between kids and their parents, mm-hmm. and where they can find a common ground and a common connection. Because, see, I believe that all parents want the best for their kids. They Absolutely. Want them to be financially independent, you know, living life to the fullest and whatnot. But what that means for parents and what that means for their kids are two different things. And I think that's where the disconnect lies.
I agree. Well, Maz, thank you so, so much for sharing your story this afternoon.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
I want to know, what job did your parents want you to do when you were growing up? And what are you actually doing today? We've got a message here saying, no name, please. I had top marks exiting high school. My parents wanted me to be a doctor or engineer. I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I followed the footsteps of my older sister who did medicine. Did what I had to do to pass the subjects every year. Felt all along it was not for me, but it was too late to change. Then about year four at uni, came across a subspecialty that not many people get into and absolutely loved it. So I'm doing that now and can't see myself doing anything else. I love my job, so thank you to my parents and knowing what's good to me when I didn't know. And JR, parents wanted me to be a doctor. Couldn't stand the smell of sterilised hospitals and the potential long hours, 72 hours plus a week, the junior doctors were facing at the time. I was good with numbers, so I became a banker instead. Parents were supportive when they realised I didn't want to be a doctor. So what about you? Let us know. What did your parents want you to do and what are you actually doing now? I reached out to my mum. This is what she said.
Hello, Helen. It's Mum here. What did I want you to do? Well, Daddy said he didn't want you to be a lawyer. That's what he always said. And I always said I wanted you, honestly, to do something that you really enjoyed. And you're always very good at reading and writing. From a very early age, you love books and you love writing, little story books you used to write and things like that. So actually, what you are doing is what I wanted you to do. So how lucky are we? Okay, love you, pet.
I don't know why she said, well, Daddy. I haven't said Daddy since I was about 5 years old, but thank you for that, Babs. Let us know. And if you're having any issues when it comes to getting on the same page as your teen, this is your opportunity to get some expert advice. 4001, and you can use the ARN Play app. We're in conversation now with Audrey Hemetina of the Bedrock Programme. She's helped many young adults and their parents make some excellent education and career choices. Maz came to you for advice. Do you see lots of people in that same situation going down a path that is ticking all the boxes apart from the enjoyment, the passion factor, Audrey?
Yes. Hi, Helen. Thank you for having me again today. And yes, I do. I see quite a number of young people that either are trying to please their parents and go down a path they're unhappy with, or a lot of parents that just sort of say, you know what, you're too young to know the difference. And until you figure it out, we've got an answer for you. So, and it's quite heartbreaking when you see these kids really struggle to get motivated for school and motivated for life when they're just not interested.
Maz said, and I think he's absolutely right, that all parents want the best for their children. It's not about choosing a career that's going to punish them. It's about choosing a career that they believe is going to give them great opportunities in life, you know, the opportunity to provide for themselves and their family. And sometimes it might be a bit misguided, but it always comes from a really good place. Can you tell us about some of the experiences you've had where that can sometimes get a bit complicated in reality?
It absolutely. He's absolutely right. And when Maz and I were spending some time working through what he actually wanted, that was one of the key messages that, you know, he understood and I reiterated. Parents are there and they love you. You know, they're not there to punish you. And just because their ideas might differ from yours doesn't mean they don't want the best for you. Actually, they do. And a lot of the work that I do, I actually end up having to spend time with the parents, not to look at, you know, oh, you want your child to be a lawyer or you want your child to be a doctor, but what is it behind the concept of being a lawyer or a doctor are you actually trying to get at? And how can we then still satisfy what you're looking for and still give your child the flexibility to pursue what they want? Mm-hmm. You know, because oftentimes it's just about making sure they'll be okay, you know, and as long as the child can communicate and reflect that back to their parents, usually parents are pretty comfortable, but you have to prove it. because they don't know about some of these newfound careers and ideas and opportunities, and they're skeptical.
It's completely understandable because it's fear of the unknown. We look at these kind of so-called professional careers, you know, your engineers, your lawyers, your doctors. It's tried and tested. They probably have friends or relatives who do those jobs, and they roughly know how much they're earning, and it's a known quantity. But say, you know, like Mavs was talking about, I want to start a tech company. It's completely abstract to a lot of parents. So I understand where that fear comes from, because it's uncharted waters. But how can young people then communicate what they want to their parents without sounding like they're rebelling or rejecting?
So a lot of it comes down to communication. And this is where I work a lot with the parent and with the teen or the young adult, because the first thing you have to do is get on the same page. Right? You have to be able to sit down together and forget about what could have happened in the past and whether or not they've supported you through other things or whether or not you think your teen is ready to make the choice. You have to sit down and almost as equal adults and say, Mom, Dad, we need to talk. This is what I'm going through. This is how I'm feeling about, you know, sort of where you're coming from. And this is why I want to pursue something else. But then the teen or the young adult also has to come to the table with a bit of clarity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really hard for a parent to take a wish that you haven't taken the time to research and understand. So when I work with the teens, they come to the table with, you know, this is kind of what the salary brackets are. Here's the profile of a few people who have done it before me. This is kind of the schooling or the other strength building exercises that I need to do to be successful. So that their parents feel like, okay, this doesn't seem so foreign. Maybe I can support you. You've actually thought this through. Let's look at it.
What if that teen or young person doesn't know? They just know they don't want to be lawyer, doctor, mechanical engineer.
Then it's important that they come to the table and say, I know for a fact I don't want to do what you're sort of suggesting, and this is why. Mm-hmm. But I don't know where I want to go with it. And I need some help. Because if you tell your parent you need help, the parent's not going to say, well, no, too bad. I've decided it's going to be this, even if you don't know yet. Most of the time, what I've seen is the parent says, okay, let's start looking into how I can support you. They take the time and they help them research. I mean, half the time people come to me is because the parent has done the research for their teen, or the teen has done the research and said, I found someone who might be able to help me. So it's about being open and honest about the conversation.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
What role do you think parents have when it comes to encouraging, maybe pushing, children into certain careers, industries, job roles? A message here from Ruhi saying, it's a cultural thing. Indian parents will always have a say in what their kids want to do in life. Otherwise, they will feel hurt and left out and think their parental responsibilities haven't been fulfilled. Agree or disagree? We're joined on Microsoft Teams by Audrey Hemetna of the Bedrock Programme. She works with young adults and often their parents, sometimes in conjunction, sometimes separately, helping them make education and career choices, getting them on the same page when sometimes they're not even reading the same book, Audrey. And we want to know from you, what did your parents want you to do versus what you're actually doing now? Doctor versus businessman has come in, say another one saying, I did exactly what my parents wanted me to do, which was get married. Classic Indian parent dream, become a lawyer or a doctor. I am now a lawyer. Audrey, I wanted to ask you, from a teen's point of view, any young people listening today, or even parents wanting to put themselves in the shoes of their teen, of their child, you know, how can a child come to the table? And you mentioned earlier about doing research, but it takes an awful lot of confidence to maybe even challenge your parents on what their intentions and hopes are. How do you get to that point, do you think?
So I think first and foremost, it's got to be a mindset shift. You're not challenging your parents. Right. So the minute you feel like you're challenging who have been the authority in your life, your entire life, like as far as you've known, it's going to get scary. And it's not something you're going to want to even consider doing. So you want to come to the table from the onset as I need to have a discussion. Right. So even if you tell yourself you're not telling your parents no, you just want to start exploring. The first thing I always say to them is, start by trying to understand what it is your parents want from you, All right. So they say lawyer. Great, mom. You know, why a lawyer? And see what they say. You know, oh, it's because, you know, I could tell Auntie so-and-so that you're a lawyer, or I missed the opportunity when I was young, or in our family, we have 16 lawyers and you'll be, you know, the legacy will continue, whatever it is. And softly sort of introduce the idea, well, what if I'm not sure that's what I want? Engage the reaction, right? So it's the same on both sides. As a parent, you're not sure how to support your child. You ask them questions. I always talk about engaging in active listening, and it goes both ways, mm-hmm. right? Teens got to sort of spend the time to try and understand, what are my parents getting at? And then parents have to try and understand, okay, this is a really tough time for teens, right? They're trying to figure out their identity. They're trying to figure out, you know, their friends. They're trying to look to the future in terms of what they want. They may not be completely there yet. Yet what I'm choosing as a parent might not also be what they want. So you got to start the dialogue somewhere. And a soft approach is always the best approach in order to create a safe space where everyone can be understanding with each other.
Audrey Houghton is with us this afternoon from the Bedrock Programme. And Audrey, I'd like to go to the text line now, 4001. And as I said earlier, you don't need to put your name on it. I know sometimes if parents are listening or you're just not sure to reveal who you are, it's absolutely fine to be anonymous and no name on this one, saying, my mother is threatening to stop supporting me financially if I choose something different to her wishes. Plan to finish uni and then study what I really like, which is graphic design. Have you come across my case? I can see you nodding on Microsoft Teams, so I'm taking that as a yes.
Yes, I have. And in unfortunately, in situations like that, that is where I usually will suggest an intervention where I actually sit down with the parent and have a coaching session to understand why they feel so dug in to that particular career that might not be serving their child, mm-hmm. right? So, and in a situation like that, I mean, there are times when you need someone else to sort of step in and say, are you sure that this is the route you want to go down? Because it's alienating your child, or you could be sending them down a career path that is not going to make them a happy adult in the end. And most parents, that's what they want. They want their child to be happy in the end. And so, you know, so they finish the schooling, you don't cut them off, and then they do something else. Now you've wasted 4 years of university, and I mean,
don't work out the money, you'll cry.
Yeah, like think about how much
think
that
about
is.
The money pit.
I mean, come on, right? And then on top of that, you've told all your friends and family that your child is going to do this, and they turn around and do something different, mm-hmm. right? So it doesn't work out to push them down that route. It works out to try and figure out how you can, you know, work with them to help them achieve their dreams. And yet you understand what you need as a parent to feel confident that you've done the parenting job that you wanted to do from the get-go.
And that you've been involved in that. You've been yeah. part of that decision and help nurture them, even if it's not in the way that you thought it was going to be. Arno's been in touch saying, my dad wanted me to be a surgeon. I'm now a successful software developer and I've got no grudges and no regret for the decision I've taken. Parents, just ask your children what they enjoy doing. If I did that, well, in fact, my daughter said to me this morning, she's like, I want to be an athlete and an artist. And she did used to want to be a dog trainer teaching dogs how to surf. So, I mean, it just goes to show you can't get too locked down on your profession, especially when you're 6 years old.
No.
Audrey, thank you so, so much. I know it's a really challenging time, as you said, for teens and young people right now. And often that mediator role, that third trusted person in their life can be really, really helpful. So thank you for all your work that you do. And you can find Audrey at the Bedrock Programme.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is Monday and it's time for Money Diaries. The brave soul putting herself in the hot seat today is Hayley Yoon. She's a 25-year-old founder and engineer of IO21, a tech startup, and throughout her programme encourages women in tech to make their voices heard. We're going to be asking here about saving versus spending, her attitude to money. But Hayley, before we get into your spending, your saving, your debts and regrets, or maybe not, can you tell us a little bit about how you got started in the tech space?
Yes, I actually wanted to become a lawyer, and I was majoring in English in college. Then I took a computer science course for fun. Then it changed my whole life. Learning a programming language was just like learning a new language, like, you know, Arabic or French. So I quickly fell in love with the subject, and it was just amazing to learn how to communicate with computer And that's how I started working in tech.
You've obviously recognized that there's a problem that needs to be addressed or solved, talking about making, you know, women's voices heard. What are some of the obstacles and attitudes that you've come up against yourself?
There are just a lot, especially in the Middle Eastern region. As a woman engineer, I am often mistaken as an admin staff or lower-level management. And there were times that someone would ask me to make coffee while no one asked my male colleagues to do so. So it's like there are a little bit of awareness and, you know, cultural problem here.
How do you respond in the moment where someone's asking you, you know, if you're the receptionist or you're making coffee and you've got to politely set them straight that you're actually you're the founder of the company?
Yes, I just have to make sure it's all professional, like nothing is personal. In that particular case, I refused to make coffee and politely reminded the person that we're in the middle of the meeting and I should be present in the meeting.
So why do you feel like women's voices have not been heard in tech for so long?
I think it's mainly because they were not present in this industry for a very long time. Tech is known as male dominant industry, and now we're, you know, we started growing women in tech, and I'm very happy to see this movement.
Mm-hmm. And what, how do you feel like you're addressing this with IO21? What's it all about?
As part of IO21, I've been trying many different ways of dealing with this problem. And I've been volunteering as a mentor at NYU Manhattan campus for Women in Computing Club. And I speak here at local schools for to support aspiring women engineers. We try to do as much as we can to inspire and make sure other women engineers don't feel like I did when I was starting my career.
It's really inspiring. And it's not just the business side. You're working incredibly hard. You're a part-time student at Stanford, completing a postgrad in AI. Just absolutely incredible, to be honest. Can you tell us a little bit about your life growing up? Where did you grow up and what was the attitude towards money in the home?
I was born in South Korea, and then I grew up in Kansas City, where it's, you know, middle of nowhere. The very first thing that I learned was not to chase money. So my parents always emphasized, chase your dream and then let money follow you. And then so far it's been working great for me, so I would like to tell advise everyone to put that behind for a little bit. It will come eventually. Focus on your dream first.
Oh, I love that. I'm to be honest with you, my brother is a musician and my parents were much the same, but because they knew he wasn't a drummer because he was trying to get out of hard work, he was drumming was his dream and he was working really hard at it. And as you say, luckily it's turned out very well. But there are others who might chase a dream that perhaps might not be financially rewarding or could lead to heartache. When do you feel like it's time to draw the line and say, okay, this hasn't necessarily worked out the way we'd hoped?
As long as you can feed yourself, you have safe place to stay, you don't have to put yourself in danger, like the security wise, and starving yourself will be like a little bit of too much. But as long as you can be in safe environment for your living life, I think you should push for your dream.
So tell us then about your attitude towards money now. I think that's an incredible philosophy to be taught as a child. Are you a saver or a spender, Hayley?
I am both spender and saver because I believe in save a lot and spend a lot.
All right. When you're spending, what are you buying? What are some of the splurges?
A lot of my spending actually goes into electronic devices and healthy food.
Ooh.
So electronic devices, I have to make sure that I test out new devices, what's new, what's trending, what are the user experience people are wanting these days. On the other hand, this healthy food is for me because you are what you eat. So I was heavily dependent on fast food diet for a couple of years, and then I had this huge health breakdown. So ever since then, I try to feed good things to myself.
What, did you have a bit of a wake up moment when it came to your health, or was it just a gradual thing?
I had one full checkup about my medical condition, and it turned out my immune system's very, very low, at like almost dangerous level. I was seeing rashes. And it was a combination of lots of things, eating instant food, not sleeping, overworking. So I had to step back and see what can I do to make sure I'm healthy enough so that I can continue working.
And really, it's an investment in your future. When you think about things like, well, health insurance for one thing, but certainly healthy food and you know, exercise, having access to good doctors. And how has it changed your life?
It's changed so much. What my work quality has drastically improved since then. Before, things that took me 20 hours, now it only takes like 5 to 7 hours. I realized the importance of investing in myself. So investing in different things are great, but I need to make sure I invest in myself, just not just money, time, effort, so that I stay healthy and stay happy.
So speaking of investments, Hayley Yoon, apart from investing in yourself, what have you invested in over the years that has worked out?
Well, the best investment so far is my startup, of course, IO21. I'm very excited that I started building my own asset, and it has great potential to grow even bigger. And I've been doing lots of investment in stock markets and startups too. So not just my startups, but like the companies that I see future in.
In terms of the stock market, we've talked about this on the show before, in terms of how men and women view money differently, and how, you know, different attitudes. And when it came to taking advice from people or teaching yourself about investing in stocks, what approach did you take?
So for me, it's as simple as finding the company that I genuinely like. So I would advise anyone to invest in what they genuinely believe in, not what's trending. I always invest my time and money into something that I want to support. And it could be the product, it could be idea or anything. If something convinces you, it has a pretty good chance of convincing other people too.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer. It is Monday and it is Money Diaries asking another brave so-and-so to tell us what they save on, what they splurge on. Today it's Hayley Yoon, 25-year-old founder and engineer of IO21. She's building her wealth, and here's what she would never invest in again.
Oh, penny stocks. I would never, ever buy penny stocks again. I know sometimes it works out for some people if they're familiar with if they do full research on the company and see the real potential, but there's like so much risk to it. That's something that I regret doing.
Well, live and learn. And, you know, you're only 25. We didn't get to learn at an early age. Obviously, there's a huge amount of potential from IO21. What are your hopes for the future of the business?
At the moment, we are growing as a tech firm, and my vision for IO21 is to grow to become a leading tech firm in the Middle Eastern region. There are many big consulting firms like Boston Consulting Group and McKinsey, and similar to these companies, we want to be the big ones in tech-specific field.
And what needs to happen for that to happen?
Well, of course, we need a strong team, because without foundation, we can't build anything. And we need to start exploring the different areas of tech development. So at the moment, we just expanded the services to include operation support and consulting, and we will continue growing.
So when you're talking about growing the team, what is it something that you look for in an employee when it's not just obviously incredible grades and academic accomplishments? What do you feel like candidates need to understand about getting on board with you?
It's about pure skill sets. So what I do when I get resume is we hide name, gender, school, anything. We do technical interview and do portfolio reviews. So 80% to 90%, it's about their skill sets, what they're capable of. And then we see if their personality matches the team and if they believe in our IO21 vision.
That's so interesting. So it's almost like blind candidates. So you don't have any kind of specific personal details. It's purely about what can they achieve, what can they offer. Have you had any surprises going down this this route?
Yes. Sometimes I get candidates who are in like freshman, sophomore, like first 2 years of college. Sometimes we have a more experienced person. It's like, it's very different. You never know who will be on the other side of the table, because lots of times people imagine young male engineer coding this, but sometimes it's 17 years old girl. Very interesting.
I love that. I love it. When we're thinking about those 17-year-old girls or even younger, Where do you think the opportunities are for women in tech moving forward? For any teenagers listening or any parents who think, you know, she's got some great STEM skills, she wants to be looking at, you know, computer sciences, university. Where do you think the job opportunities and, you know, the industry opportunities will be in the next few years?
I am rooting for, and I am suspecting that fintech will grow very fast with the crypto and blockchain system getting onboarded with government entities and private sectors. And also, I've been following a lot about the medical trends, and they are upgrading the system with the new technology. So a lot of potential there too.
I think health has been, obviously, for pandemic purposes, really put under the spotlight. And something we've been talking about an awful lot on Dubai Eye is exactly that, you know, AI applications when it comes to healthcare, from cancer detection to personalised medicine to, you know, genetic testing. It's going to be a really, really fascinating time. Is that something you're tempted to dabble into yourself?
Actually, that's the first thing that I tried as an engineer. So I used to work at medical school as a research assistant. So our team was half neuroscientists, half software engineers developing tools for patients. It was just great to see how, even though I'm not a surgeon, how I could indirectly help people finding their diseases, help them cure through like algorithms.
And coming back to kind of what you're doing now, I know a big part of IO21 is to do with, you know, development of mobile apps.
I think it's about the need. Everyone has heard about this AI possibly taking over the world, you know, taking away everyone's job. For me, my point of view, I actually view it a little differently. I think they're a tool to enhance our lifestyle. And I think the application that they stay are those. Application that's like very popular are mostly that can make changes into someone's like daily life. Mm-hmm. There are meditation application, planner, chat application. There are like enhancements, like a benefit that upgrades their lifestyle.
And I know this is going to be a very difficult question, but what are some of your most used apps that you find yourself going back to time and time again, Hayley, on your phone?
Definitely planner app. My planner, I've downloaded this application that is like a mega planner with to-do list, 5 different calendars, 5 different emails, everything into one. I've been using this for like months. I can't live without it.
What's it called? That sounds like I need it in my life.
It's called Time Page.
Time Page, right. I will pick up my phone and have a look, because we all need a bit more organization in our life. Thank you so, so much for your time, Hayley.
Oh, that was really fun. Thank you, Helen.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking careers this hour and in conversation with Hamza Zawali. He's the author of The Job Seeker and The Coach. He's got decades of experience as a recruiter and is working as a career coach. So, Hamza, before we get to our topic of the day, which is that niggling feeling that you're not in the right job, but you're not quite sure how to identify what job you actually want, or indeed how to get it, let's tackle the kind of the elephant in the room. What is happening with the state of recruitment right now? I'm hearing very mixed reports. I'm hearing some people cannot get a job for love nor money, whereas I'm also hearing people are on a hiring spree. What's your industry insider take on Dubai right now?
Yeah, the job market is deciding where it's going right now. So there's indeed these two conflicting, you know, movements are going on. So you have salaries are offered are being challenged a little bit because there's so many job seekers in the market that employers can do that. And at the same time, you have employers thinking, should we hire now or should we wait a little bit longer, i.e. fourth quarter of this year. It's a good thing in the sense that it's definitely moving in the right direction. More and more employers are talking about hiring more and more, growing. I think that we're just going to go through a period of 2 or 3 months of, you know, defining how the new job market, the post-COVID job market is going to be. And that takes a little bit of a transitory, you know, movements, I guess.
Now, historically, we would have Ramadan and into a summer where decisions might be a bit quieter. You believe that actually these kind of so-called quiet periods can actually be a really good time to be looking for a job. So are we expecting some movement, some action over the next couple of months, or is it pressing pause until September?
I think it's not pressing pause, but historically, whether there is Ramadan or not, there's school holidays, a big break, summer break, obviously. And that means a lot of expats leaving. Some of these expats, especially those who have kids, are going to be over 30, 35 years of age, and therefore in a position of decision-making in a company, so sometimes 40, 45. And that is why decisions can be slower. So is there going to be jobs as usual? Yeah, for sure. But in terms of interviews, feedback, things are going to feel a little bit slower. So it's just a temporary thing. But what I always advise people is don't wait till the end of August to start applying, because positioning yourself right now, super, super important for September, because September is going to be, I believe, is going to be back on track, you know, in a very, very good way, because it's 3 months away from the end of the year. It's 1 month away from Expo. It's a lot of things that are going to be, you know, everyone is coming back. The good days hopefully are coming back as well in terms of, you know, how people would consume, go back out. There's a lot of confluence in September, October. So my advice is do your part, position yourself now, write your CV. Now is a good time. It's a fantastic time to reflect on your CV. Right now is a fantastic time to take a step back and fine-tune your application techniques, etc., etc. The summer is key. It's very, very important, I think.
And it's exactly that reflection that we're talking about today. As I referred to, that niggling feeling that you're getting up, going to a job, whether that is at your desk in your home or in an office right now, and you're not feeling fulfilled, you're not doing something that is sparking joy, to rip off Marie Kondo, but also, you know, it's not something that's fulfilling you, even if you're getting paid for it. And it's in some ways a bit of a luxury, because a lot of people simply don't enjoy their job, but just get on with it because they have got bills to pay. But when do you feel like that niggling feeling becomes a serious problem?
There's really two aspects. We need to first define where this comes from. The more we feel something negative and we don't know where it comes from, what is exactly the source, we can't tackle it. And that's a very, very dangerous situation to be in. The more we feel like this, the more we disengage with the actual current job, the more we grow, we reinforce that sense of, you know, we cut off our power source, we disengage with the possibilities, et cetera, et cetera. So that's very, very important to first say, hang on, where does it come from? It usually comes from two boxes, categories. Either it's the element of the job itself meaning, you know, the manager, the culture, you're lacking the skill, you're not having good results. It's extremely hard to like something when we fail at it, when we don't have good results. It's extremely hard to have an amazing manager when you're not very good at what you do. So it could be the element of the job, the company itself, the culture, colleagues sometimes. Or it could be that something a bit deeper, which is, you know, not feeling fulfilled, not having a job that means something for the person. And we have to identify on one side, you know, if it's the element of a job, you can change it by doing something. And the number one question that I ask people is, okay, what did you do about it? So you don't like your job. How many books about job search did you read? Did you speak to people about other career opportunities? How many times a week or a month are you arranging this? What are you doing about it? Do you have a side hustle, you know, an after work passion that you are developing, whether it's your own business, it doesn't matter, you know, a degree or whatever. Are you moving forward? If it's the other side, the sort of meaningfulness of what you're doing, you know, it's strange times, really. We are inundated with things like, oh, find a job that you like and you'll never have to work a day in your life.
That'd be nice.
You know, find your passion. Exactly. Find your passion. And sometimes it feels weird when people don't have that dream job or they don't have that passion. Not having a passion or not having your job as a passion is actually the common, you know, the most standard.
Isn't that pretty normal?
You know,
exactly, you know, think about right? Percentage of people who are like, I am working in my passion and I'm getting paid handsomely for it. That's got to be a handful. But Hamza, why do you feel like meaningful work is important to most people?
It is important because, you know, as human beings, we're not machines, right? The only thing that separates us from machines is to connect it with a why. Why do we do what we do? Do we just go to the gym because, well, we are programmed to go to the gym? Or do we go to the gym because we have a higher purpose, health, you know, mental, body health, obviously, or whatever? And I think having meaning, the why, is what makes us human. So, you know, remove the why from people and suddenly they don't feel that much, you know, alive as they would if they had that why, if that makes sense. They don't feel like they're going somewhere towards the why, or there is a reason why they're going through the gym, right? The exercise, the sweating, the discomfort, the out of breath. And if you don't have that why, then it feels, well, useless. Why am I suffering for nothing?
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Hi, Helen, with you. And we are talking careers with Hamza Zuali. He's the author of a book called The Job Seeker and the Coach. He has decades of experience as a recruiter and a career coach. And if you feel like you're not in the right job, but you don't know what you want to do, maybe he can help you. He believes you might feel you've wasted your time doing something you don't like, or maybe even you hate. But if you think about it, everything has a purpose.
Usually what we perceive as waste of time, the fact that it doesn't have meaning right now, we live in an age of instant gratification, right? It's got to mean something right now. Well, it's not exactly the case. When you look back 5 years ago, 10 years ago, you say, well, you know what? If I didn't do that, I didn't like it that time. But if I didn't do that, I wouldn't have learned to, I wouldn't have become XYZ. I wouldn't have met XYZ. I wouldn't have developed XYZ. It makes sense sometimes after years. I always refer to working as going to the gym. You know, it's not the work itself that's enjoyable. It shouldn't be enjoyable. It's work. Essentially, going to the gym requires that, well, you're going to go through a period of discomfort, out of breath, you know, sweat, body pain, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody likes that. And to say, well, I don't know if I like exercising, as long as you have a purpose, it makes sense, right? If you only get the value of what you're doing now, the discomfort you're going through now, later on. You have to change. Your situation can't change if you don't change. And a job is a change agent. Use the job as your daily exercise too, because you are certainly, you and I, Helen, for example, are not the same as 5 years ago, 10 years ago. A job is something that helped us fine-tune some things, improve, reinforce other aspects of our personality, of this and that. And I think that just for that, if you think about a job not as a, hey, I've got to love it, or I should be something different, I should be doing something different. The only reason I accept people, I accept from people that want to change job is if they say, actually, the job is making me become someone that I absolutely don't want. If I become successful, it means that my personality will be like this, and I don't want that. Then there's a disconnect. I agree with the disconnect here. If you are successful in what you're doing, what kind of person are you becoming? Is this getting you closer to your goals? Changing you for you to hit that purpose, for you to achieve that, you might be in a good job.
Maybe a mindset adjustment rather than a lifestyle complete switch up.
As long as that's aligned with the person you want to become, connected with the purpose that you have, your personal goals, in order to become, I don't know, financially free, I need to be able to be a good salesperson. I'm making this up. So is the job I'm in helping me reinforce or improve my negotiation skills or my tenacity or my resilience? It's only when we look at things in a sort of, we take distance and we say, okay, if we trace a line with what I know now, where is this going? Here's my purpose. I'm not going to expect someone to give me a purpose here. I'm going to give it a purpose. And you know what? In 1 year, you might fine-tune that purpose. You might change it. It doesn't matter. That's the journey you're in. All the opportunities are going to come through. When I first started my career in recruitment, my boss told me, you didn't choose to work in recruitment. Recruitment chose you. A job chooses you. It stayed with me. And this is the case for a lot of people. They find themselves as, oh, really? I can do this job, I have an interview, and they found themselves starting something they didn't necessarily choose. Trust the future. You know, it's not just about right now. We've got to expand our vision. And if you expand and it's not in line with the person you want to be, with your values, your principle, yeah, change jobs. ASAP, for sure. Does it make sense?
Makes perfect sense. Hamza Zuwali there, author of the book, The Job Seeker, and The Coach.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.